Jimmy Dunlop. He thinks he's a real man.
Thanks for trying, anyway.
The big man heaved a deep sigh and then said,
Sorry for being rude all morning. I needed time to heal up from yesterday. I needed time to check you out. And I guess I needed time to get used to the idea of being in jail.
I can sure identify with that. I've never been in jail before.
Hank tried again.
He extended his hand and said, Hank Bush.
This time the man took it and gave him a firm shake.
Marshal Hogan.
Then something clicked for both of them. Before they had even dropped their hands again, they looked at each other, pointed at each other, and both began to ask,
Say, aren't you?
And then they stared for a moment and didn't say anything. The angels were watching, of course, and brought Tal word.
Good, good, said Tal. Now we'll just let those two talk. You're the pastor of that little white church, Marshall said.
And you're the editor of the paper, the Clarion, Hank exclaimed.
So, what in the wide world are you doing here?
I don't know if you'd be able to believe it.
Kid, you'd be amazed. I'm amazed at what I believe.
Marshall lowered his voice and leaned close as he said,
They told me you were in here for rape.
That's right.
That sounds just like you, doesn't it?
Hank didn't quite know what to make of that statement.
Well, I didn't do it, you know.
Doesn't Alf Brimmel go to your church?
Yes.
Ever cross him?
Well, yes.
So have I. And that's why I'm in here, and that's why you're in here. Tell me what happened.
When?
I mean, what really happened? Do you even know this girl you supposedly raped?
Well,
where'd you get those bite marks on your arm?
Hank was getting some doubts.
Say, listen, I'd better not say anything.
Was her name Carmen?
Hank's face said a yes that was almost audible.
Just thought I'd take a stab at it. She's really a treacherous gal. She used to work for me, and last night she told me she'd been raped, and I knew then that it was a lie.
Hank was completely flabbergasted.
This is too much. How do you know about all this?
Marshall looked around the cell and shrugged.
Oh, well, what else is there to do? Hank, have I got a story for you? It's going to take a few hours. You ready for that?
If you're ready to hear mine, I'm ready to hear yours.
Hello? Ma'am?
Bernice jolted awake. There was someone leaning over her. It was a young girl about high school age, maybe older, with big brown eyes and black curly hair, dressed in bib overalls, a perfect farmer's daughter.
Oh, hi.
It was all Bernice could think of to say.
Are you all right, ma'am?
The girl asked in a slow and easy drawl.
Yes, I was just sleeping. I hope that's all right. I was out for a walk, you know, and...
She remembered her bruised face. Oh, great. Now this kid will think I've been mugged or something.
You looking for your sunglasses?
The girl asked, reaching down and picking them up. She handed them to Bernice.
I guess you're wondering what happened to my face.
The girl only smiled a disarming smile and said,
Why, you ought to see how I look when I first wake up. I take it this is your property. I didn't mean to... No, I'm just passing through like you are. I saw you lying here and thought I'd check up on you. Can I give you a lift anywhere?
Bernice was about to say an automatic no, but then she looked at her watch. Oh, no. It was almost 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Well, you wouldn't happen to be going north, would you? I'm heading up toward Baker.
Oh, that's perfect.
I could catch a ride with you. Right after lunch.
What? The girl walked out of the trees to the next field of corn, and then Bernice noticed a shiny blue motorcycle parked in the sun. The girl reached into a side saddle and brought out a brown paper sack. She returned and set that sack in front of Bernice along with a carton of cold milk.
You ate lunch at 4 in the afternoon?
Bernice asked with a conversational chuckle.
No,
the young lady answered with a chuckle of her own. "But you've come a long way, and you have a long way to go, and you need something to eat."
Bernice looked into those clear and laughing brown eyes, and then at the simple little lunch bag in front of her, and she could feel her face turning red and her eyes filling up.
"Eat up now," said the girl.
Bernice opened the paper bag and found a roast beef sandwich that was truly a work of art. The beef was still hot, the lettuce crisp and green. Below that was a carton of blueberry yogurt, her favorite flavor, still cold to the touch. She tried to keep her emotions down, but she began to quake with weeping, and the tears ran down her cheeks. "Oh, I'm making a fool of myself," she thought. But this was so altogether different.
"I'm so sorry," she said. "I'm just very touched by your kindness."
The girl touched her hand.
"Well, I'm glad I could be here. What is your name?"
"You can call me Betsy."
Well, you can call me Marie."
It was Bernice's middle name.
"I'll just do that. Listen, I have some cold water, too, if you want that."
There came another wave of emotion.
"You're a wonderful person. What are you doing on this planet?" "Helping you,"
Betsy answered, running to her motorcycle for the water. Hank sat on the edge of his cot, enraptured by the story Marshall was relating.
"Are you serious?" he responded suddenly. "Alfred Mel is into witchcraft? A board member in my church?"
"Hey, call it what you want, bub, but I'm telling you, it is spacey. I don't know how long he and that Langstrat have been bosom buddies, but enough of her cosmic consciousness crud has rubbed off on him to make him dangerous, and I mean that."
"So, who's in this group again?"
"Who isn't in it? Oliver Young's in it, Judge Baker's in it, most of the cops on the local police force are in it."
Marshall went on to give Hank just a small segment of the list. Hank was amazed. This had to be the Lord. So many of the questions he had had for so long were finally finding their answers. Marshall kept going for another half an hour or so, and then he started losing momentum. He had come to the part about Kate and Sandy.
"That's the part that hurts the most," he said, and then started looking out through the bars instead of into Hank's eyes. "It's a whole other story in itself, and you don't need to hear it. But I sure went over and over it this morning. It's my fault, Hank. I let it happen."
He heaved a deep breath and wiped wetness from his eyes.
"I could have lost everything. The paper, the house, the battle. I could have taken it if only I had them, but I lost them too."
Then he said the words,
"And that's how I ended up here."
And he stopped, abruptly. Hank was weeping. He was weeping and smiling, raising his hands up to God, shaking his head in wonderment. To Marshall, it looked like he was having some kind of religious experience.
"Marshall,"
Hank said excitedly, unable to sit still,
"this is of God. Our being here is no accident. Our enemies meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. He's brought the two of us together just so we could meet, just so we could put the whole thing together. You haven't heard my story yet, but guess what? It's the same. We've both been coming up against the exact same problem from two different sides."
Tell me, I want to cry too."
So Hank began telling how he suddenly found himself the pastor of a church that didn't seem to want him. Betsy's motorcycle flew like the wind up Highway 27, and Bernice held on tight, sitting behind her on the soft leather seat, watching all the scenery go by. The whole trip was exhilarating. It made her feel like a kid again, and the fact that both of them wore helmets with dark face shields made Bernice feel all the more safe from discovery. But Baker was coming up rapidly, and with it the risks and dangers and the big question of whether Susan Jacobson would even be there or not. Part of Bernice wanted to stay on the motorcycle with this sweet, likable kid and just keep right on going to wherever. Any life had to be better than this one. The landmarks became familiar, the Coca-Cola sign and that big lot full of firewood for sale. They were coming into Baker. Betsy let off the throttle and started whining down through the gears. Finally, she pulled off the highway and bumped along to a stop in a gravel parking lot just in front of the aged Sunset Motel.
"Will this do for you?"
Betsy shouted through her face shield. Bernice could just make out the evergreen up the highway.
"Oh, yeah, this'll do just fine."
She climbed off the motorcycle and struggled with the chin strap of her helmet.
"Leave it on a while," said Betsy. "What for?"
Bernice's eyes immediately gave her a good reason that she would know of. A squad car from the Ashton precinct just happened to drive by, slowing down as it entered Baker. Bernice watched as it then signaled left and pulled into the parking area in front of the Evergreen Tavern. Two officers got out and went inside. She looked down at Betsy. Did she know? She didn't act like it. She pointed to a little diner attached to the motel.
"That's Rosalyn's little cafe. It looks like a terrible place, but she makes the best homemade soup in the world, and she sells it cheap. It'd be a great place to kill some time."
Bernice removed her helmet and set it on the bike.
"Betsy," she said, "I owe you a very great debt. Thank you so very much."
"You're welcome."
Even through the face shield, that smile shone brightly. Bernice looked at the little cafe. No, it didn't look very nice.
"The best soup in the world, eh?"
She turned back to Betsy and stiffened. For a moment, she felt she would stumble forward as if a wall had suddenly disappeared in front of her. Betsy was gone. The motorcycle was gone. It was like awaking from a dream and needing time to adjust one's mind to what was real and what was not. But Bernice knew it had not been a dream. The tracks of the motorcycle were still plainly visible in the gravel, leading from where it had left the highway to the spot directly in front of Bernice. There they ended. Bernice backed away, stunned and shaken. She looked up and down the highway, but knew even as she did that she would not see that girl on her motorcycle. As a matter of fact, as a few more seconds went by, Bernice knew she would have been disappointed if she had. It would have been the end of a very beautiful something she had never felt before. But she had to get off the highway, she kept telling herself. She was sticking out like a sore thumb. She tore herself away from that spot and hurried into Rosalyn's little cafe. Dinner came through the bars at 6. Marshall was ready to eat the fried chicken and cook carrots, but Hank was so much into his story that Marshall had to prompt him to eat.
"I'm really getting to the good part," Hank protested, and then he asked, "How are you keeping up with this?"
"A lot of it is new," Marshall admitted.
"What were you again, Presbyterian?"
"Hey, don't blame them. I'm just me, that's all. And I always thought that spooks only come out on Halloween."
"Well, you always wanted an explanation for Langstrat's strange pull and how the network could have all that powerful influence on people and what may have been really tormenting Ted Harmel and especially who these spirit guides might be."
You're asking me to believe in evil spirits?"
"Do you believe in God?"
"Yes, I believe there's a God."
"Do you believe in a devil?"
Marshall had to think for a moment. He noticed that he'd gone through a change of opinion somewhere along the line.
I guess I do."
"Believing in angels and demons is simply the next step after that. It's only logical."
Marshall shrugged and picked up a drumstick.
"Just keep going. Let me hear the whole thing."
Chapter 34 Bernice killed another hour and a half in Rosalyn's cafe, buying a bowl of Rose's soup. Betsy was right, it was good, and eating it very slowly. She kept her eye on Rose the whole time. Boy, if that woman made one move toward that telephone, Bernice was going to be out of there. But Rose didn't appear to think a beat-up woman in her cafe was all that unusual, and nothing happened. When 7:30 rolled around, Bernice knew that she would have to try for that meeting one way or another. She paid Rose for the soup out of the change in her pocket and stepped outside. It looked like that police car that had stopped at the Evergreen was gone now, but the light was getting poor, and it was too far away for Bernice to tell for sure. She would just have to take it one step at a time. She walked along carefully, her eyes looking in all directions for police, stakeouts, suspicious vehicles, anything. The parking lot of the Evergreen was overflowing, and that was probably typical for a Saturday night. She kept her sunglasses on, but apart from that, she looked every bit like the Bernice Krueger the police were searching for. What else could she do? As she approached the tavern, she looked here and there for any escape routes. She did notice a trail going back into the woods, but had no idea how far it went or where it eventually led. All in all, there didn't seem to be too many places to run or hide. The back of the Evergreen Tavern was the one part of the building nobody seemed to care about at all. The three old cars, the forgotten refrigerators, the dented beer kegs, and the piles of delaminating tables and rusting broken-through chairs were parted just enough to allow a narrow pathway to the back door. This door also scraped an arc in the linoleum. The music from the jukebox hit Bernice like a wave, as did the smoke from cigarettes and the sickeningly sweet smell of beer. She closed the door after her and found herself in a dark cavern full of silhouettes. She cautiously looked over, under, and around her sunglasses, trying to see where she was and where everybody else was without taking the sunglasses off. There had to be some place to sit in here. Most of the booths were full of loggers and their girlfriends. There was one chair in the corner. She took it and settled in to survey the room. From this spot she could make out the front door and could see people coming in, but she could not distinguish their faces. She did recognize Dan behind the bar. He was pouring beers while trying to keep a bridle on things. Her ears verified that the shuffleboard game was in full swing, and two video games against a far wall were bleeping and burpling through the quarters. It was 7:50. Well, just sitting here wasn't going to work. She felt too obvious, and she simply couldn't see. She got up from her chair and tried to mingle with the crowd, staying close to the walls. She looked at Dan again. He was a little closer, and he could have been looking back at her, but she didn't know. He didn't act like he recognized her or cared if he did. Bernice tried to find an unobtrusive spot from which to look at the people at the front tables. She joined a small group around one of the video games. These people in the front were still silhouettes, but none of them could have been Susan. There was Dan again, leaning over one table and pulling the front window shade half down. Some of the people nearby didn't like it, but he gave them some explanation and left it that way. She decided to go back to her chair and wait. She worked her way back to the shuffleboard game, then went slowly behind the crowd toward the back of the room. Then a thought hit her. She had seen that pulling down the window shade trick in some movie. A signal. She turned her head toward the front, and at that exact moment the front door opened. Two men in uniforms came in. Police. One pointed right at her. She moved as quickly as she could for the back door. It was nothing but dark in front of her. How in the world was she even going to find that door? She could hear a shout over the noise of the crowd. "Hey, stop that woman! Police! You! Hold it!" The police around her began muttering. "Who? What woman? That woman?" What other voice out of the blackness said, "Hey, lady, I think he's talking to you!" She didn't look back, but she could hear the shuffling of chairs and feet. They were coming after her. Then she saw the green exit sign over the back door. Forget about keeping cool. She broke into a run toward that light. People were hollering everywhere, coming to help her, wanting to see what was going on. They got in the policeman's way, and the police started hollering. "One side, please! Get out of the way! Stop her!" She couldn't see the latch or knob or whatever that door had. Hoping it had a crash bar, she slammed her body against it. It didn't have a crash bar, but she could hear something break, and the door opened anyway. It was lighter out here than inside. She could make out the path through all the junk and race through it, running for all she was worth, just as she heard the back door crash open again. Then came the sound of their footsteps. Could she get out of sight before they got clear of all that junk? She tore off her sunglasses just in time to spot the trail through the woods on the other side of the fence. It was amazing what a person could do when scared enough. Planting her hands on top of the fence, she swung her body up and vaulted over it, tumbling down into the brush on the other side. Without stopping to congratulate herself, she scrambled up that trail into the woods like a scared rabbit, ducking to avoid the low-hanging branches she could see and being whipped in the face by the one she couldn't. The trail was soft and clear and kept her footsteps quiet and muffled. It was darker in the woods, and at times she had to stop abruptly just to see where the trail led next. During those times, she would also listen for her pursuers. She could hear some kind of yelling going on far behind her, but it seemed no one had thought of this trail. There was light up ahead. She came to a gravel back road, but hesitated in the trees long enough to look up and down that road for cars, cops, anyone. The road was quiet and deserted. She stepped out quickly, trying to decide which way to go. Suddenly, at an intersection a little way down the road, a car appeared, pulling onto this road and heading her way. They had to have seen her. There was nothing to do but keep running. Her lungs were laboring, her heart was aching and felt like it would pound itself apart, her legs felt like lead. She couldn't help crying out in anguish and fear with each exhalation as she ran across the field toward a cluster of buildings in the distance. She looked back. A figure was after her, running swiftly in hot pursuit. "No, no, please don't chase me. Just let me go. I can't go on like this." The buildings were getting closer. It looked like an old farm. She was no longer thinking, only running. She couldn't see. Her eyes were doubly blurred now with tears. She was gasping for breath. Her mouth was dry. The pain from her ribcage shot up and down her whole side. The grass whipped against her legs, almost tripping her with every step. She could hear the footsteps of her pursuers swishing through the grass not far behind her. "Oh, God, help me!" Ahead was a large, dark building, a barn. She would go for it and try to hide. If they found her, they found her. She could run no further. She stumbled, trudged, dragged one foot after the other around one end, and found the big sliding door half open. She practically fell through it. Inside, she found herself in inky blackness. Now her eyes were useless to her. She stumbled ahead, her arms out in front of her. Her feet were shuffling through straw, her arms bumped into boards. A stall. She went further, another stall. She could hear the footsteps coming around the corner and through the door. She ducked into one of the stalls and tried to quell her gasping. She was on the verge of fainting. The steps slowed. The pursuer was encountering the same darkness and trying to feel his way along, but he was coming closer. Bernice backed further into the stall, wondering if there might be some way to hide herself. Her hand encountered some kind of handle. She felt downward. A pitchfork. She took it in her hands. Could she really use this thing in cold blood? The footsteps moved ahead methodically. The pursuer was checking each stall, working his way through the barn. Now Bernice could see a small beam of light sweeping here and there. She held the pitchfork high as her cracked rib punished her in protest. "You're going to be very sorry you ever chased me," she thought. She was playing by jungle rules now. The footsteps were very close now. The little beam of light was just outside the opening. She was ready. The light shined in her eyes. There was a slight gasp. "Come on, Bernice, throw the pitchfork." Her arms would not move.
"Bernice Kruger?"
asked a muffled female voice. Bernice still didn't move. She held the pitchfork high, still panting for air, the little shaft of light illuminating her crazed, blackened eyes and her terrified face. Whoever it was stepped back abruptly at the sight of her and whispered,
"Bernice, no! Don't throw it!"
That made Bernice want all the more to throw that thing. She was whimpering and gasping, trying to get her arms to move. They would not.
"Bernice," came the voice. "It's Susan Jacobson. I'm alone."
Bernice still did not put down the pitchfork. For the moment, she was beyond rationality and words meant nothing.
"Do you hear me?" came the voice. "Please, put the fork down. I won't hurt you. I'm not the police, I promise you." "Who are you?"
Bernice asked finally, her voice gasping and quivering.
"Susan Jacobson, Bernice."
She said it again, slowly.
"Susan Jacobson, your sister Pat's old roommate. We had an appointment."
It was as if Bernice suddenly recovered from a hallucination or a sleepwalking nightmare. The name sank into her mind at last and awoke her.
"You," she panted. "You gotta be kidding." "I'm not. It's me."
Susan shone her little penlight on her own face. The black hair and pale complexion were unmistakable, even though the black clothes were replaced now with jeans and a blue jacket. Bernice lowered the pitchfork. Then she dropped it and let out a muffled wail, putting her hand over her mouth. She suddenly realized she was in terrible pain. She sank to her knees in the straw, her arms around her ribcage.
"Are you all right?"
Susan asked.
"Turn out that light before they see you,"
was all Bernice would say. The light clicked off. Bernice could feel Susan's hand touching her.
"You're hurt,"
Susan said.
I try to keep everything in perspective," Bernice gasped. "I'm still alive. I found the real Susan Jacobson. I haven't had to kill anybody. The police haven't found me. And I have a cracked rib. Ooh!"
Susan put her arms around Bernice to comfort her.
"Gently, gently," Bernice cautioned. "Where in the world did you come from? How did you find me?" "I was watching the tavern from across the street, waiting to see if you or Kevin would show up. I saw the police go in and you running out the back, and I knew it was you right away. We college kids used to hang around here a lot, so I knew about that trail you took, and I knew how it emptied out into that road out there. I drove around thinking I could head you off and let you jump into my car, but you were too far ahead of me and you took off running."
Bernice let her head drop a bit. She could feel herself getting emotional again.
"I used to think I'd never seen a miracle, but now I don't know."
Hank finished his whole story, and with Marshall's prodding had also put away most of his dinner. Marshall began to ask questions, which Hank answered from his knowledge of the scriptures.
"So," Marshall asked and mused at the same time, "when the Gospels talk about Jesus and his disciples casting out unclean spirits, that's what they were really doing."
"That's what they were doing," Hank answered. Marshall leaned back against the bars and kept right on thinking.
"That would sure explain a lot of things. But what about Sandy? Do you suppose that she's...
"I don't know for sure, but it could be.
What I talked to yesterday, that wasn't her. She was just crazy. You wouldn't have believed it," he caught himself.
Then again, you probably would." Hank was excited.
"But don't you see what happened? It's a miracle of God, Marshall. All along, you were looking into this racketeering and intrigue and wondering how these things could be happening so smoothly and so forcefully, especially in the individual lives of so many people. Well, now you have your how. And now that you've told me what you found out and all that you've been through, I have my why. All this time I've been encountering demonic powers in this town, but I never really knew just what they were up to. Now I know. It has to be the Lord who brought us together."
Marshall gave Hank a wry smile.
"So, where do we go from here, preacher? They've locked us in. They haven't allowed us any communication with our families, friends, lawyers, or anyone. I have a feeling that our constitutional rights aren't going to have much to do with it at this juncture."
Now Hank leaned back against the cold concrete wall and thought about it.
"That part only God knows. But I have a very strong feeling that he got us into this and that he also has a plan for getting us out." "If we must talk about strong feelings," Marshall countered, "I have some pretty strong feelings that they just want us out of the way while they finish once and for all what they've started. It's going to be interesting to see what's left of the town, our jobs, our homes, our families, and everything else we treasured once we get out of here. If we get out of here."
"Well, have faith. God's in control here."
"Yeah. I just hope he hasn't dropped the ball."
As the two women sat there in the straw in the dark, Bernice tried to explain everything to Susan, her battered face, her cracked rib, what she and Marshall had been through, and the death of Kevin Weed. Susan digested it all for a moment and then said,
"It's Caseph's way. It's the society's way. I should have known better than to have brought Kevin into it. Don't blame yourself. All of us are in this thing, whether we really want to be or not.
Susan forced herself to be unemotional and calculating.
You're right, at least for now. Someday soon I'll sit down and really think about it, and I'll weep over that man.
She stood up.
But right now there's too much to do and too little time. Do you think you can walk? No, but that hasn't stopped me so far. My car is rented, and I have too many important materials in it to leave it sitting out there. Come on.
With careful and very quiet, well-picked steps, Susan and Bernice made their way to the big barn door. It was very quiet out there.
Want to go for it?
Susan asked.
Sure, said Bernice. Let's do it.
They started back across the expansive field toward the road where Susan had left her car, using one tree that jutted up against the starry sky as their heading. As they crossed the field again, Bernice noted how much shorter the trip seemed now that she was not fleeing for her life. Susan led the way to where her car was parked. She had pulled it off the road a little way and nestled it in among some trees. She began fumbling in her pocket for the keys.
"Susan!"
said a voice from the woods. The two of them froze.
"Susan Jacobson?"
came the voice again. Susan whispered excitedly.
"I don't believe it."
Bernice answered,
"I don't believe it either." "Kevin?"
Some bushes began to move and swish, and then a man stepped out of the woods. There was no mistaking that lanky frame and that lazy walk.
"Kevin Weed?"
Bernice had to ask again.
"Bernice Kruger," said Kevin. "You made it. Oh, that's great."
After a short moment of speechless amazement and surprise, the embraces came automatically.
"Let's get out of here," said Susan.
They piled into her car and put some miles between themselves and Baker.
"I got a motel room in Orting, up north of Windsor," said Susan. "We can go there."
It was okay with Bernice and Kevin. Bernice said very happily,
"Kevin, you've just made a liar out of me. I thought for sure you were dead."
"I'm alive for now," Kevin said, not sounding too sure about anything.
"But your truck went into the river."
"Yeah, I know. Some jerk stole it and crashed it. Somebody was trying to kill me."
He realized he didn't make much sense, so he started over.
"Hey, I was on my way to meet you at the bridge, like you said. I stopped at the Evergreen to have a few, and I bet some guy slipped me a Mickey. You know, put something in my beer. I mean, I got stoned. I was driving down the road to meet up with you, and I was really spacing out, so I pulled over at Tucker's Burgers to throw up or get a drink of water or go to the bathroom or something. I fell asleep in the men's room, man, and I must have slept there all night. I woke up this morning and went outside, and my truck was gone. I didn't know what happened to it until I read about it in the paper. They must still be searching the river for my body."
"It's obvious Kasif and his network have us all marked," said Susan. "But I think somebody's looking out for us. Kevin, something very similar happened to me. I ran away from Kasif's ranch on foot. And the only reason I got away was because all the security personnel went chasing somebody else who was trying to get away in one of the big moving vans. Now, who in their right mind would try that? And just at that precise moment?"
Bernice added,
"And I still haven't figured out who in the world that Betsy was."
Susan had been formulating her theory for days.
"I think we'd better start thinking about God."
"God?"
"And angels," Susan added.
She quickly recounted the details of her escape and concluded,
"Listen, somebody came into that room. I know it."
Kevin piped up,
"Hey, like, maybe it was an angel that stole my truck."
And then Bernice recalled,
"You know, there was something about Betsy. It made me just cry. I've never run into anything like that before."
Susan touched her hand.
"Well, it looks like we're all running into something, so whatever we do, we'd better pay attention."
The car continued to speed along back roads, taking a slightly roundabout route toward the little resort town of Orting. Like two comrades in arms, Marshall and Hank were beginning to feel they had known each other all their lives.
"I like your kind of faith," Marshall said.
It's no wonder they tried so hard to get you out of that church. He chuckled a little. Boy, you must feel like the Alamo. You're the only thing standing between the devil and the rest of the town.
Hank smiled weakly.
I'm not much, believe me. But I'm not the only one. There are saints out there, Marshal. People praying for us. Sooner or later, something's going to break. God won't let Satan have this town that easy.
Marshall pointed his finger at Hank, even shook it a little.
See there? I like that kind of faith. Good and straight, laid right on the line.
He shook his head.
Sheesh, how long has it been since I've heard it come across like that?
Hank seasoned his words with salt, but he knew the time had come to say it.
Well, Marshall, since we're talking so straight here, right on the line, what do you say we talk about you? You know, there could be some more reasons God put us in this cell together.
Marshall was not defensive at all, but smiling and ready to listen.
What are we going to do, talk about the fate of my eternal soul?
Hank smiled back.
That's exactly what we're going to talk about.
They talked about sin, that aggravating and destructive tendency of man to stray from God and choose his own way, always to his own hurt. That brought them around to Marshall's family again, and how so many attitudes and actions were the direct result of that basic human self-will and rebellion against God. Marshall shook his head as he saw things in this light.
Hey, our family never did know God. We only went through the motions. No wonder Sandy wouldn't buy it.
Then Hank talked about Jesus, and showed Marshall that this man, whose name was so casually thrown around, and even trampled upon in the world, was far more than just a religious symbol, a lofty, untouchable personality in a stained-glass window. He was the very real, very alive, very personal Son of God. And he could be the personal Lord and Savior of anyone who asked him to be.
I never thought I'd be lying here listening to this, Marshall said suddenly. You're really hitting me where it hurts, you know that?
Well, said Hank, why do you suppose that is? Where's the pain coming from?
Marshall took a deep breath as he took the time to think.
I guess from knowing that you're right, which means I've been wrong a long, long time.
Jesus loves you anyway. He knows that's your problem, and that's what he died for.
Yeah, right.
Chapter 35 The motel in Orting was nice, quaint, homey, just like the rest of this town situated along the Judd River on the border of the National Forest. It was a stopping place for sportsmen, built and decorated in a pleasing hunt-and-fish, hike-in-the-woods motif. Susan wanted no trouble or attention, so she paid for two more occupants for the room that night. They went into the room and pulled the shades. They all made a stop in the bathroom, but Bernice remained just a little longer, carefully rewrapping her ribs and then washing her face. She looked herself over in the mirror and touched her bruises very gingerly, whistling at the sight. It could only get better from here. In the meantime, Susan had flopped her big suitcase on the bed and opened it up. When Bernice finally came out, Susan took a small book from the suitcase and handed it to her.
This is where it started, she said. It's your sister's diary.
Bernice didn't know what to say. A diamond would not have been a greater treasure. She could only look down at the little blue diary in her hands, a last surviving link with her dead sister, and struggle to believe it was really there.
Where? How did you get this? Julian Langstrat made sure no one ever saw it. She had it stolen from Pat's room, and she gave it to Kasif, from whom I stole it. I became Kasif's girl, you know. His maidservant, he called it. I had regular access to him all the time, and he trusted me. I came across the diary one day while I was straightening up his office, and I recognized it right away because I used to watch Pat write in it almost every night in our dorm room. I sneaked it out, read it, and it woke me up. I used to think Alexander Kasif was... Well, the Messiah, the answer for all of mankind, a true prophet of peace and universal brotherhood.
Susan made a face like she was getting sick.
Oh, he filled my mind with all that kind of talk, but somewhere deep inside I always had my doubts. That little book right there told me to listen to the doubts and not to him.
Bernice thumbed through the pages of the diary. It went back a few years and seemed very detailed. Susan continued,
"You may not want to read it just now. When I read that diary, well, it made me sick for days."
Bernice wanted the end of the story.
"Susan, do you know how my sister really died?"
Susan said angrily,
"Your sister Pat was methodically and viciously done away with by the Universal Consciousness Society. Or, I should say, the forces behind it. She made the same fatal mistake I've seen so many others make. She found out too much about the society. She showed herself to be an enemy of Alexander Kasev. Listen, what Kasev wants, he gets, and he doesn't care who has to be destroyed, murdered, or mutilated to make sure of it."
She shook her head.
"I had to be blind not to have seen it happening to Pat. It was right out of the textbook." "So, what about some man named Thomas?"
Susan answered directly.
"Yes, it was Thomas. He was responsible for her death."
Then she added rather cryptically,
"But he wasn't a man."
Bernice was slowly catching on to this new game with its very weird rules.
"And now you're going to tell me it wasn't a woman either. Pat was taking a psychology class, and one of her requirements was that she be in a subject pool for psychology experiments. It's in the diary, you'll read it all. A friend persuaded her to volunteer for an experiment involving relaxation techniques. And it was during the experiment that she had what she called a psychic experience, some kind of insight into a higher world, she called it. I'll make it short. You can read it for yourself later. She became extremely enamored by the experience and saw no connection between this scientific exploration and the mystical practices I was into. She kept going back, kept taking part in the experiments, and finally contacted what she called a highly evolved, disembodied human from another dimension, a very wise and intelligent being named Thomas."
Bernice struggled with what she was hearing, but knew she held the documentation for Susan's account, her sister's diary.
"So, who was this Thomas, really? Just a figment of her imagination?" "Some things you're just going to have to accept for now," Susan replied with a sigh. "We've talked about God, we've toyed with the idea of angels. Now let's try evil spirits, evil spirit entities. To the atheistic scientists, they might appear as extraterrestrials, often with their own spaceships. To evolutionists, they might claim to be highly evolved beings. To the lonely, they might appear as long-lost relatives, speaking from the other side of the grave. Jungian psychologists consider them archetypal images, dredged from the collective consciousness of the human race."
"What?"
"Hey, listen, whatever description or definition fits, whatever shape, whatever form it takes to win a person's confidence and appeal to his vanity, that's the form they take. And they tell the deluded seeker of truth whatever he or she wants to hear, until they finally have that person in their complete control. Like a con game, in other words. It's all a con game. Eastern meditation, witchcraft, divination, science of mind, psychic healing, holistic education. Oh, the list goes on and on. It's all the same thing. Nothing but a ruse to take over people's minds and spirits, even their bodies."
Bernice reviewed memory after memory of their investigation, and Susan's claims fell right into place. Susan continued,
"Bernice, we are dealing with a conspiracy of spirit entities. I know. Kasev is crawling with them and takes his orders from them. They do his dirty work. If anyone gets in his way, he has numberless resources in the spiritual realm to clear away the problem in whatever manner is most convenient."
Ted Harmel, Bernice thought. The Carlucci's. How many others?
"You're not the first person to try to tell me all this. I hope I'm the last person who will have to."
Kevin piped in,
"Yeah, I remember how Pat talked about Thomas.
He never sounded like he was human. She acted like he was more of a god. She had to ask him before she'd even decide what to eat for breakfast. I thought she'd found some guy, you know, some male chauvinist type.
Susan eased into the bottom line of the story.
Pat had given her will over to Thomas. It didn't take long. It usually doesn't once a person really submits to a spirit's influence. No doubt he took control of her, then terrified her, then convinced her that, well, the Hindus call it karma. It's the delusion that your next life will be better than this one because you've earned enough brownie points. In Pat's case, a self-inflicted death would be nothing more than a way to escape the evil of this lower world and join Thomas in a higher state of existence.
Susan gently flipped the pages of the diary still in Bernice's hands and found the last entry.
There. The last thing in Pat's diary is a love letter to Thomas. She planned to join him soon, and she even mentions how she'll do it.
Bernice could feel revulsion at the thought of reading such a letter, but she began to work her way through the last few pages of her sister's diary. Pat wrote in a style of someone under a very strange, lofty-sounding delusion, but it was clear she was also disoriented by an irrational fear of life itself. Terrible pain and spiritual anguish had taken over her soul, changing her from the happy-go-lucky Patricia Kruger that Bernice had grown up with to a terrified, aimless, psychotic, completely out of touch with reality. Bernice tried to read on, but she began to feel old wounds reopening. Emotions that had waited for this very moment a final revelation burst from their hiding places like a river through an open floodgate. The scrawled and ambling words on the pages blurred behind a sudden cascade of tears, and her whole body began to quake with sobs. All she wanted to do was shut out the world, disregard this gallant woman and this poor disheveled logger, lie down on the bed and cry. And she did. Hank slept peacefully on his cot in the cell. Marshall was not sleeping at all. He sat up in the dark, his back against the cold, hard bars of the cell, his head drooping, his hand making nervous little trips around his face. He had been shot through the guts. That's what it felt like. Somewhere he had lost his armor plating, his strength, his strong and tough facade. He had always been Marshall Hogan, the hunter, the hound, the stay-out-of-my-way getter of whatever he wanted, a foe to be reckoned with, a guy who could take care of himself. A lump, that's what he was, and nothing but a fool. This Hank Bush was right. Just look at yourself, Hogan. Don't worry about God dropping the ball. You dropped it a long time ago. You blew it, man. You thought you had everything under control, and now where's your family, and where are you? Maybe you've been tricked by these demons Hank's been talking about. And then maybe you've even fooled yourself. Come on, Marshall. You know why you shortchanged your family. You were copping out, singing the same old tune again. And you enjoyed working with that good-looking reporter, didn't you? Teasing her, tossing paper wads at her, for crying out loud. How old are you, 16? Marshall let his own mind and heart tell him the truth, and much of it felt as if he had known it somewhere, but had never listened. How long, he began to wonder, had he been lying to himself? Kate, he whispered there in the dark, his eyes glistening with tears. Kate, what have I done? A big hand reached across the cell and nudged Hank's shoulder. Hank stirred, opened his eyes, and said quietly,
"Yeah, what's up?"
Marshall was weeping, and he said very quietly,
"Hank, I'm just no good. I need God. I need Jesus."
How many times in his life had Hank said the words,
"Let's pray."
After several minutes had passed, Bernice began to feel the flood subsiding. She sat up, still sniffling, but trying to get back to the business at hand.
"That's what woke me up," Susan reiterated. "I thought these beings were benevolent. I thought Kasif had all the answers. But I saw them all in their true form when I read what they did to my best friend, your sister."
Kevin asked,
"So, is that why you came up to me at the carnival and got my number?"
Kasif had a special meeting in town with Langstrat and some other vital conspirators, Oliver Young and Alf Brimmel. I came to Ashton with Kasif, tagging right along as I always did. But when I got the opportunity, I sneaked away. I had to take the chance that maybe I'd see you somewhere. Maybe it was God again. It was nothing short of a miracle that I spotted you at the carnival. I needed a friend on the outside I could confide in, someone obscure.
Kevin smiled. Yeah, that describes me pretty well.
Susan continued. Kasif never liked to feel that he didn't have complete control of me. When I slipped away to the carnival, he probably told the others that he'd already sent me there and that they would meet me. When he found me and dragged me behind that silly booth, he talked to them like I had gone ahead and picked out that spot.
Bernice said,
And that's when I came across you and snapped your picture. And then Brimmel slipped some bills to those two hookers and some instructions to a few of his Windsor friends, and you know the rest.
Susan went to her suitcase.
But now for the really big news. Kasif is making his move tomorrow. There's a special meeting scheduled with the Whitmore College Regents at 2 p.m. Omni Corporation, as a front for the Universal Consciousness Society, plans to buy Whitmore College, and Kasif is closing the deal.
Bernice's eyes widened with horror.
Then we were right. He is going for the college. It's good strategy. The whole town of Ashton is practically built around that college. Once the society and Kasif get established there at Whitmore, they'll have overwhelming influence over the rest of the town. Society people will come in like a swarm, and Ashton will become another sacred city of the universal mind. It's happened enough before, in other towns, in other countries.
Bernice pounded the bed in frustration.
Susan, we have records of Eugene Baylor's financial transactions, evidence that might show how the college was undermined. But we haven't been able to make any sense of it all.
Susan pulled a little canister out of her suitcase.
Actually, you only have half the picture. Baylor's no fool. He knew how to cover his tracks so his embezzlements on behalf of Omni wouldn't be noticed. What you need is the other side of those transactions, Kasif's own records.
She held the canister out for them to see.
I didn't have room for all that material. I did photograph it, though. And if we could get this film developed... We have a dark room at the Clarion. We could print that film right away. Let's check out of here.
They scrambled. The remnant continued to pray. None had been able to see or even hear from Hank since his arrest. The police station was manned at all times by strange police no one had ever seen in Ashton before. And none of these officers knew anything about how to visit anyone in jail or how to bail them out, nor would they let anyone in to find out. It seemed Ashton had become a police state. Fear, anger, and prayer increased. Something terrible was happening to the town, and they all knew it vividly. But what could be done in a town with deaf authorities, in a county whose offices were closed for the weekend? The phone lines continued to hum, both in the town and going out across the country to relatives and friends, all of whom dropped to their knees to intercede and call their own authorities and legislators. Alf Brimmel stayed away from his office, avoiding any distraught Christians with sermons to deliver about their pastor's constitutional rights, or an official's duty to the will of the people, or anything else. He remained in Langstrat's apartment, pacing the floor, worrying, sweating, waiting for 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. Grandma Duster kept praying and reassuring everyone that God had everything under control. She reminded them of what the angels had told her, and then many recalled what they had dreamed or heard in their mind while praying, or seen in a vision or felt in their spirits. And they continued to pray for the town. And everywhere, from every direction, new visitors continued to arrive in the town of Ashton, riding in on passing hay trucks, hitchhiking in like summer backpackers, gliding in through the cornfields and then through the back streets, roaring in like wild bikers, bussing in like high schoolers, hiding in the trunks and under the bellies of every vehicle that traveled through on Highway 27. And steadily the nooks, crannies, unused rooms, and countless other hiding places all over the town became alive with still, silent figures, their burly hands upon their swords, their golden eyes piercing and alert, their ears tuned to one particular sound from one particular trumpet. Above the town, concealed in the trees, Tal could still look out across the wide valley and see Rhaefar in the big dead tree, overseeing the activities of his demons. Captain Tal continued to watch and wait. In the remote valley, a rapidly growing cloud of demon spirits churned for a radius of 2 miles all around the ranch, towering as high as the mountaintops. Their numbers were beyond counting, their density such that the cloud totally obscured anything within it. The spirits danced and wailed like drunken brawlers, waving their swords, raving and drooling, their eyes wild with madness. Myriads of them paired off, jousting, sparring, testing one another's skills. In the darkened center of the cloud, in the big stone house, the strong man sat with narrowed eyes and a crooked smirk that deepened the folds of his sagging face. In the company of his generals, he took time to gloat over the news he had just received from Ashton.
"Prince Rhaefar has satisfied my wishes. He has fulfilled his mission," the strong man said, and then bared his ivory fangs with a drooling smile. "I will like that little town. In my hands it will grow like a tree and fill the countryside."
He savored the next thought.
"I may never have to stir myself from that place. What do you think? Shall we have our home at last?"
The tall and loathsome generals all muttered affirmatively. The strong man rose from his seat, and the others snapped to a stiff and upright stance of attention.
"Our Mr. Kasif has been calling me for some time now. Prepare the ranks. We will leave immediately."
The general shot out through the roof of the house into the cloud, shrieking their orders, assembling their troops. The strong man unfolded his wings in a regal manner, then floated like a monstrous overweight vulture into the basement room where Alexander Kasif, sitting cross-legged on a large cushion, chanted the strong man's name again and again. The strong man alighted right in front of Kasif and observed him for a moment, drinking in Kasif's worship and spiritual groveling. Then, with a swift movement, the strong man stepped forward and let his huge frame dissolve into Kasif's body, as Kasif twitched and writhed grotesquely. In a moment the possession was complete, and Alexander Kasif awakened from his meditation.
"The time has come," he said with the strong man's look in his eyes.
Chapter 36 Susan turned the rented car into the little gravel parking area behind the Ashton Clarion. It was 5 in the morning and just beginning to get light outside. Somehow, as far as they knew, they had not been seen by any of the police. The town seemed quiet, and the day promised to be pleasant and sunny. Bernice went to a special hiding place behind a pair of dented garbage cans and found the key to the back door. In a quick and silent moment, all three were inside.
"Don't turn any lights on, make any noise, or go near any windows," Bernice cautioned them. "The dark room's in here. Everybody come in before I turn on the light."
All three squeezed into the little dark room. Bernice closed the door and then found the light switch. She prepared her chemicals, double-checked the film, then got the little developing tank ready. She switched off the light and they stood in total blackness.
"Freaky," Kevin said.
"This will only take a few minutes. Boy, I haven't the slightest idea of what's happening to Marshall, but I don't dare to try to find out." "What about your answering machine? There might be some messages on it."
"That's a thought. I can check that out as soon as I get this film all loaded in here. I'm almost finished." Then Bernice had another thought.
"I wonder about Sandy Hogan, too. She pitched a lamp at her father and ran out of the house." "Yes, you were telling me about that. I don't know where she'd go unless she's decided to run off with that Sean character."
"With who?" Susan asked abruptly.
"Who did you say?" "Some guy named Sean." "Sean Ormsby?" Susan asked. "Uh-oh, it sounds like you know him." "I'm afraid Sandy Hogan could be in real trouble. Sean Ormsby appears quite a few times in your sister's diary. He's the one who got Pat involved in those parapsychology experiments. He encouraged her to continue them, and he's the one who eventually introduced her to Thomas.
The darkroom light clicked on. The developing tank was loaded and ready, but all Bernice could do was stare white-faced at Susan. Madeline was not a beautiful, golden-haired, highly evolved super.